This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of the world's best-known neurologists, Dr. Oliver Sacks. He's famous for his books collecting case studies of patients with neurological disorders that have produced strange distortions of reality. One now famous example is the title story of his book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. In Sacks's book, Awakenings, which was adapted into a film, he told the stories of patients awakened by medication after years of being institutionalized with a Parkinsonian sleeping sickness. Through such stories, Sacks offers insights into the brain and our experience of reality. In his new book, Sacks considers the profound effect that music has on us and tells the stories of people with neurological disorders that have altered their perceptions of music and their musical abilities. These case studies pose larger questions like, why do some people have perfect pitch while others can't hum a tune? The book is called Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain. Oliver Sacks, welcome back to Fresh Air. You tell many amazing stories in the book. The book opens with one of a 42-year-old orthopedic surgeon who was using a payphone in a phone booth during a lightning storm, and his head was struck by lightning through the phone. What change did it produce in him musically?
He was hurled backwards, and he was in effect killed for a short time. He had a cardiac arrest for maybe 30 seconds, and of course his brain got no oxygen during that time. And he had some immediate consequences, loss of memory and so forth. This came back. But then he developed a sudden insatiable passion, as he put it, for hearing piano music, and then for playing piano music, despite the fact that he'd been really without any particular musical taste or talent all his life. Then he started to have dreams that he was composing music, and when he woke, the music was still going through his head, and so then he wanted to be a composer as well as a performer. And all of this happened really in the course of two or three days in which he was completely transformed. He continued to work as a surgeon, but he started getting up at 3 a.m. He got himself a piano teacher. He learned to transcribe the music which was going through his mind. But this change has been permanent, and in 15 years now, he has become quite an accomplished musician in a way which could never have been predicted before.
What does that story tell you about what happens neurologically with music? Like, what do you take away from that story?
Well, I don't know exactly what has happened with him, and I hope we can sort of get some brain imaging and functional brain imaging and see what has happened. This sort of imaging was not available, really, in the early 90s when he was struck by lightning. But there are a number of situations in which there may be a rather sudden, astonishing release or emergence or heightening of musical abilities. One sometimes sees this with epilepsy, with temporal lobe epilepsy. One sometimes sees it with a rare disease called frontotemporal degeneration, when the temporal lobes get released and music and visual patterns can play in the mind. I suspect that something like that happened with the surgeon.
You know, you mentioned epilepsy. You worked in an epilepsy clinic for a while, so you were exposed to a lot of people with epilepsy. And you write about how some people with seizures would hear, like, beautiful music, but other people would be tormented by music. The music would be horrible for them.
Occasionally, music can cause a seizure. I saw a patient, I describe her, who told me that she had been found unconscious with a bitten tongue next to the radio 3 or 4 years ago. And all she could say was that she had heard some Neapolitan songs being played on the radio, songs which she normally loved, but these produced a queer feeling, a strange, faint feeling, and then she couldn't remember anymore. And this was regarded as an unhelpful piece of history. But then she had another seizure, another convulsion, also following a Neapolitan song. And it became apparent that Neapolitan songs would give her seizures and no other music. She came from a large Sicilian family, and Sicilian and Neapolitan music was always being played. If it was played at a wedding, she had about 20 seconds to block her ears and get out of earshot. Otherwise, otherwise she would be taken over. And she was sort of heartbroken because this was music she loved, and now she started to dread it. Now, there have been many cases in the literature. Sometimes it's a particular form of music. Sometimes it's a particular instrument. In one case, it was a peal of bells. Someone would be found unconscious by the radio at 9:01 every night without fail in Australia. And it turned out that it was the sound of bow bells was played just before the 9 o'clock news every night. And that would knock him out. Nothing else would.
Which part of the brain deals with music?
Well, a great many different parts of the brain deal with music, but the auditory parts of the brain obviously deal with music in the first place, with the sound of music. Then there is analysis of the pitch and the rhythm and the timbre and the melody, melodic contours and other aspects of music in different parts of the brain. The motion of music, the tempo and the rhythm, is separately registered, and so also is the emotional reaction to music. So there are really 20 or 30 different parts of the brain which are being recruited in the musical experience. And these are never quite the same in any two people.
Is language as complex as that? Does it call on as many parts of the brain as music does?
Language doesn't seem to call on as many parts of the brain. And this may be a reason why, if one has a stroke or something and loses language, knocks out a particular language area in the left hemisphere, one usually retains one's musical sensibility, and one can still recognize and sometimes sing songs.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks, and his new book is called Musicophilia, The Tales of Music and the Brain. What have MRIs allowed researchers to see about the differences between musicians and non-musicians in the brain?
Well, there have been very, very striking findings here. People have been looking for some sort of cerebral correlate of intelligence or of musicality or artistic gifts or literary gifts for ages. When Einstein died, his brain, in fact, was stolen by the pathologist and subsequently cut into little bits and distributed. People wanted to find out what was Einstein's secret. Nothing clear-cut really came of this. And in general, if you look at a brain, either in life with an MRI or later, you can't tell whether it's the brain of a genius or a fool, whether it's the brain of a visual artist or a literary artist, but you can look at a brain and say that's probably the brain of a musician, because musical training and involvement in music enlarges various parts of the brain, the corpus callosum, the great band which goes between the two cerebral hemispheres, parts of the auditory cortex, parts of the cerebellum, parts of the frontal lobe cortex. There are striking changes which can occur within a year or with a single year of musical training. And these are changes which are really visible to the naked eye, at least if one knows where to look. So the power of music to alter the brain is very, very striking.
Is this a chicken and egg thing? Is a person with a certain kind of brain and certain enlarged parts within the brain that becomes a musician, or is it the musical training that has the impact on the brain?
We don't fully know, because usually one does not do an MRI on a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old, a gifted 3- or 4-year-old, before they start musical training. I think we need to do this, but what we do know is that the musical training itself can make very great changes. Though obviously some people are born, with greater musicality and others not. Usually innately musical people get early and intense musical training.
Have you ever looked at an MRI of your brain and analyzed your brain?
Yes, actually, quite recently, both a structural MRI, which to my relief did not show Alzheimer's or anything like that. But I've also been looking at a functional MRI of my visual cortex because I've been fascinated by certain visual phenomena and visual experiences, and I want to know what my brain is like, what the visual brain is like. I'd also like to do some auditory MRIs, listening to music.
So what did you learn from your own MRIs about your brain?
Basically that it seems similar to other people's brains. although having said that, as one examines it in more detail, you do in fact find that that MRIs, and especially functional MRIs, are as individual as fingerprints. And this is especially so with musical responses. No two people are exactly the same. And sometimes, an individual's functional MRI with music may change over the years as they change, as perhaps, as you described earlier, when perhaps a tune which didn't move you much, heard years later, is strangely familiar and gets you. Something must have happened, and I think that, that could probably be shown up if one had an MRI of the earlier hearing and then a functional one of the later hearing.
You describe somebody who has perfect pitch in your book and who wonders, why is it that people are mystified at perfect pitch, yet everybody seems to be able to describe and name, to see and name colors. Now, to me, being able to identify a G or, a G above C or an A sharp or something is completely different than being able to say that's turquoise.
I take it that you don't have absolute pitch then.
I sure don't.
nor do I. But to people who do have it, it seems to be as natural to say G sharp as to say turquoise, and they don't have to make any explicit comparison with any other pitch, just as we can say something as turquoise without having to compare it to pink or green. There's some suggestion that all of us may have absolute or perfect pitch in the first year of life, but then the vast majority of us then lose it. Although with intensive musical training, it's more apt to be retained. So absolute pitch may occur in something like 1 in 10,000 people in the general population, but it's closer to 1 in 10 or 1 in 15 with professional musicians.
But the thing is that, notes like G and A and B flat, they're just kind of like human constructs. Like, they don't exist. That scale doesn't exist in nature. It was created by humans. So.
I suppose one might say that blue and green don't exist in nature. I mean, there is a continuous spectrum of wavelengths, but we arbitrarily pick out a certain segment of that and say, we'll call this blue or we'll call this green. And similarly, I think out of a tonal continuum, we will pick out a particular thing and, we will divide an octave. An octave is a universal. It's a mathematical universal and it's a physiological universal. Middle C has double the frequency of the C below it, half the frequency of the C above it. And every human being can tell an octave. And if we then divide an octave arbitrarily into, say, 18 steps, or whatever, then we get our particular scale. The Hindu scale is different. I mean, obviously, culture comes into it, but there is something natural as well.
Now, the first book you ever wrote was about migraines, and this was after you'd seen about 1,000 patients with migraine early in your career. And you got, or maybe still get, I'm not sure which, migraines yourself. And do you still get them?
I still get them occasionally. I usually don't get a headache. I usually just get the visual phenomena of migraine, which I confess fascinate me. They frightened me when I first had them as a little boy, because you can be blinded to one side or lose the sense of colour or the sense of movement, and you see sort of blinding zigzags like lightning. But now I feel it's a certain privilege seeing the brain at play. and knowing, of course, that this is benign and that it'll last quite for an hour and then it goes away.
And in the lingo of migraines, that's called aura. But you write about some people who get like a musical equivalent of that. Instead of seeing things, they hear things with a migraine.
One can certainly get auditory equivalents. Sounds become much louder or much more remote. And on one occasion, more than 30 years ago, I had a very odd experience myself. I was driving in the car. I had the radio on. I was listening to a Chopin ballad on a now defunct classical radio station. It was 103.4. It was a favorite station. And then suddenly the music seemed to change, and the there was a sort of odd resonance or banging or reverberation, and tonality seemed to drain out. And finally, it was as if the ballad was being played on steel drums or hammered on a steel sheet. I could only recognize it because it kept the rhythm and the structure of the ballad, but tonality had vanished. And I phoned up the radio station as soon as I... And then after about 10 minutes, the tonality and the melody came back. And I was very, very puzzled. I phoned up the radio station and I said, was that a sort of joke, an experiment? What were you doing? And they said, we weren't doing anything. You better check your car radio. But then this happened a second time when I happened to be at home and indeed playing the piano. And again, the tonality drained out, and it was as if I were playing a metal sheet instead of the beautiful old Bechstein, which I have. But at the same time, then I saw one of these scintillating zigzags, and this time it was synchronous with the visual aura of migraine, and I realized that I was having a brief amusia, a sort of a musical aura, at the same time, and that the migraine must be hitting the auditory parts of the brain as well as the visual.
I have to say, you know, I've never had anything happen to me the way you described it, but when I get a headache, it's the only time I find music kind of unpleasant. It's like I have no appetite for music when I have a headache.
Yeah. Does it seem unusually loud? Does it hurt? Or?
No, it's not that severe. It's just irritating in a way that I never find music. I mean, music I love will be irritating.
Yeah. Do you lose your taste for anything else when you're in that state?
Well, you know, all of life kind of becomes pretty... when you have a bad headache, everything kind of is not very pleasant. But you know, music can often lift you out of an unpleasant circumstance, but I find not with a headache.
Yeah. I asked my question because there are certain states sometimes after a concussion in which one can lose one's taste for music or indeed actively dislike it, but nothing else. There's no change of mood or change of aesthetic generally. And it is just as if response to music and that only changes.
Huh, that's interesting. Didn't you get fired for writing that book instead of getting a book award?
yes, I did. I'd forgotten that I'd spoken or written of this. At that time I worked in a headache unit, and my boss was in fact very upset that I devoted a lot of attention to the non-headache parts of migraine, like the visual parts we've been speaking of, and he didn't want me to write the book and told me that I would never get another job if I proceeded. But I finally did proceed, and the book came out. I had the most joyful release of my life when that book came out in 1970. I've had a lot of books since, but nothing was attended with quite the fear and then the delight that migraine was. It was so forbidden, but then it came about.
Why was it seen as such a bad thing to write about the non-headache part of headache, like the visual aura?
It did seem sort of strange, but I remember my former boss sort of banging the table and said, "Sachs," he says, "you're working in a headache unit. You know, you stick to headache." I think he was a little crazy, but but also I was an intimidated junior, and people can get can get very irrational.
Right.
Though in particular, he himself was known and rightly known as a headache expert. He'd done sort of good original research, and I think he didn't want me altering the emphasis.
You know, one thing I often wonder is why are familiar melodies so special to us? You know, like you can go to a concert and really like the new songs a performer does, but when the performer does the song that you already know and like, the familiar song, there's just a different feeling that overcomes you. And I have found that even songs I might not have liked in their own time, when I hear them now, this isn't always true, but it's sometimes true that the familiarity of it kind of overtakes me and just gives me that feeling of musical familiarity that feels so good. Do you wonder, like, what causes that? Why is there, like, a special groove in your brain that seems to resonate with familiar melodies?
And familiarity always goes, I think, with a feeling of a particular memory, a particular place, a particular mood, a particular emotion. And there's a very, very intense relationship between music and memory and emotion. I think music has a tremendous mnemonic power, which, of course, Proust writes about. I think nothing, you know, it's almost as powerful as taste or smell. Music brings back things. But as you say, familiarity alone can do it and can sort of give one goosebumps, bring back one's early years.
You write not only about music that we hear, but you write about music hallucinations, music that only exists in our minds. And you say that you became interested in musical hallucinations when your mother, at the age of 75, started hearing patriotic songs from the Boer War playing incessantly in her mind. First, you should tell us what the Boer War was and why your mother would know those songs.
My mother herself was surprised because she was only 7 at the time, and the Boer War was going on in South Africa. And in general, a 7-year-old child is not that interested in a remote war. But there were lots of patriotic songs were being sung in England at the time. But my mother was intensely surprised. She said that she thought these songs had never meant anything much to her in the first place. And secondly, she hadn't given them a conscious thought, in nearly 70 years. And now suddenly they were erupting inside her. She knew that it was going on in her head. She didn't feel that, you know, the songs were actually being played. And so she wondered what had happened. She herself had been trained in neurology. She wondered if she'd had a little stroke. She wondered if it was the medication she was taking for high blood pressure. Whatever it was, the songs died down in a week or so, and they never recurred. And it was just a strange little episode.
What do you make of it?
I was intrigued and also slightly frightened by this. I'm now in my 75th year, and it doesn't seem that old. But at the time, I thought of my mother as very old, and I wondered whether, you know, in my end is my beginning, whether the mind was somehow preparing to go, preparing to depart, and regurgitating very, very early memories. I was also very much reminded of something which I'd read a few years earlier, when about people with temporal lobe epilepsy who would sometimes suddenly have songs come into their head, and it had been found that particular parts of the brain responded to that, although that was different because they would have, as it were, a seizure with a song going through their head for 2 minutes and maybe some twitching movements, maybe unconsciousness, whereas what my mother described was a sort of kaleidoscope of songs going on continuously for hours on end. And I didn't know what to make of it. But I was intrigued. And later, in the 1970s, I was to encounter this in several of my patients, most of whom were rather deaf. Although at that time I noted that they were deaf without making any explicit connection between the auditory hallucinations and the deafness. And in some of these cases, people were really very uncertain as to what was going on. One old lady was woken in the middle of the night by hearing Irish songs played tremendously loudly. You know, a hallucination is quite unlike imagery. You feel musical imagery as your own. You think of a song, whereas a hallucination startles you. You look around. You wonder what's going on. Someone turned on a radio. Is there a band outside? And this woman wondered why music was playing loudly in the middle of the night in a nursing home. She wandered out. She was amazed that everyone else was asleep. She thought they'd all been sedated. She couldn't find a radio. She wondered whether a filling in her tooth was acting as a crystal radio, as a transistor. And then finally she had to infer that something was occurring in her brain, which she called a radio in her brain, which was behaving autonomously and convulsively. This can be very frightening to people. They, you know, one associates hearing things. People wonder, are they going mad? You know, is their brain rotting? And in fact, there's been a great underreporting of musical hallucinations, I think, because people are afraid to mention them.
Well, I was going to say, I hear much more about visual hallucinations than auditory ones. Though, you know, people who hear voices...
Yeah,
have auditory hallucinations, but I guess that's different from music hallucinations.
Yeah, it's completely different because, you know, the voices are accusing or persecuting or humiliating or seductive, whatever. The voices seem to be addressed to one. They seem to be moral agencies. They make one acutely uncomfortable. And none of this is the case with a musical hallucination, which is like a sort of automatic replay of music one has heard in early life, which may not mean anything in particular to one. Typically, people with musical hallucinations never get voice hallucinations. And one of the first things, you know, if people have these is to, you know, is to listen carefully to their story and reassure them that this is not psychotic, that it's completely different from a psychotic hallucination.
Now, I've read that you've been in therapy since 1966, and correct me if that's a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I have no secrets, or very few. Yes, I have.
Well, here's one of the things that interests me about that. With all that we've learned about the biochemistry of like mood and behavior and everything, do you feel that talk therapy, you know, as a neurologist, do you feel that talk therapy is actually helpful?
It depends on the situation. If someone is, you know, in an acute psychosis or acutely manic, then I think that may not be the time for talk therapy. You need some chemical therapy. But I think that for long-standing neuroses, which perhaps have a long sort of powder trail going back to conflicts of the family or whatever... then talk therapy may be crucial. It is expensive of time and attention, but this may sometimes be the only way of addressing certain problems. I also think, and at the moment there's a new discipline coming up called neuropsychoanalysis, which is trying to see if there are neurological changes associated with neuroses and also with their treatment. I would certainly think that if people do well in an analysis or in prolonged psychotherapy, that you would find structural brain changes to go with this.
Now, I've read that in 1961 you were a consulting physician for the Hell's Angels, and it seems like such an unusual fit. You're such the kind of like erudite, intellectual, shy You know, neurologist, like, how did you get hooked up with the Hells Angels, and what was your job? Yeah.
Well, it wasn't exactly a job. I mean, I am now a consultant for the Little Sisters of the Poor, and I was not it was not a similar consultancy with Hells Angels. No, at that point, I sort of grew up with motorcycles. My father had a motorcycle. There was a sidecar. Much of my childhood was spent in a sidecar, so obviously when I was 16 or 17, I got a motorbike myself. And when I came to the States, I don't know what term to use. I was going to say I fell in. I didn't. I somehow had some contact with Hell's Angels then, and they in fact found me a mild, shy, non-judgmental figure with some medical knowledge. And people would have accidents, they would have headaches, there would be fights, and so there was a little informal medical advice. But that's the beginning and end of it.
How do you somehow get in contact with the Hells Angels?
Well, you're on the road. You have a bike, and at that time there was a sort of brotherhood or fraternity among bikers.
So did you have to fix up a lot of fight wounds?
Yes, I wasn't terribly good at it because I'm actually rather clumsy. My mother was a surgeon, and when she saw how clumsy I was, she said, you know, you better go into neurology where you don't actually have to do anything. But I did my best.
Now, you've described yourself as being very shy, and you've said in previous interviews that your shyness can be crippling, which you certainly wouldn't know from this interview. But do you think that as like a psychological disorder, a neurological issue, just like a personality trait? Like, what's your analysis of your shyness?
All of the above. There is good evidence, including with some animal studies, that sort of timidity or audacity are to some extent inborn, although obviously they can be modified a great deal by experience. For me, there was a period of intimidation in the war, in World War II, when I was evacuated between the ages of 6 and 10 and bullied very much. And a friend who knew me before said I was a rather pugnacious, forthright kid of 5. And when I came back at the age of 10, I was rather timid and withdrawn. So there obviously sort of a negative experience played a big part. But there are all sorts of situations in which I'm not shy. I'm often more at ease with a large audience than with a single person. I'm something of a ham, it has been said. I think they're probably right. But I do freeze in social situations, and I don't have small talk, and I sort of don't. I don't quite know how to conduct myself, and I will tend to stand in a corner until maybe something comes up which really interests me, and then I change and I start talking, and I can then, as it were, become a social focus rather than a social recluse. So there's an odd dynamic.
Do you see this as a problem, something that needs to be fixed, or just the way you are?
I feel it as a problem, and my mother, who was intensely shy in social situations, you know, felt it as a problem. But then I deal with it on the whole by avoiding social situations. I'm comfortable with a few friends, and paradoxically, I may be comfortable with an audience. And but above all, I'm comfortable I'm comfortable at the typewriter. I'm comfortable reading and writing, and I think to some extent the written word for me forms a refuge from speech and society, which I need every so often, which I need crucially.
Your mother was a surgeon, and when you were young, apparently she brought home, I think, what, like fetuses and limbs and stuff to dissect and to teach you about the human body. Now, a lot of children would take the, like, yuck point of view in any kind of dissection. What did it teach you about the human body when you did dissections with your mother? Like, and not just about the anatomy of the human body, but about an attitude toward the human body.
My an older brother of mine, who's also a physician, felt I should not have spoken of this when I wrote my memoir, Uncle Tungsten. He said, people won't understand. It didn't seem to me that, or to my friends, that unusual that the son of a doctor, the son of an obstetrician, should sort of be brought things to dissect. Although I was very young at the time, I was only 10 or 11, and it did give me the creeps as well. My mother was also a professor of anatomy. She adored anatomy. She was fascinated by anatomical structure and human structure. I don't think she realized how frightening this would be to a child.
Was it frightening because it was the inside of a body, or because it was about death, or both?
Both, and also a particularly sad, grim sort of death, because these were people basically who had never lived, who were stillborn. Mm-hmm. And some of the tragedy of this, and wondering what their mothers thought, and a whole wretched situation, I sometimes thought must have been associated with this. So I couldn't just see them as anatomical specimens, but as sort of as the expressions of a tragedy.
Do you feel in some ways your work has become as a neurologist more about like observing the human condition, often in extremes, as opposed to trying to like cure people?
I want to see people better. And for example, with Awakenings, when L-DOPA became available, this was a fantastic sort of breakthrough. I mean, these people would have remained in the abyss had it not been for something like L-DOPA, which could awaken them. There are huge changes of all sorts are going on in medicine and in neurology. But there are also terrible conditions like whatever Huntington's disease, Huntington's chorea, which are incurable. My own special interest is in rehabilitation, or in general, sort of exploring with people, if they've lost some power, other ways of doing things. If they're visually impaired, I will explore with them sort of other ways of reading, other ways of getting around. I don't think anyone is incurable. Something can always be done. I'm certainly not a passive observer. I hope I'm not an intrusive or tyrannical intervener, as some doctors are, but I'm always looking out with the patient for what can be done.
Dr. Sachs, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Lovely talking with you, Terry.
Oliver Sachs is the author of the new book, Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain. He's also a professor of clinical neurology at Columbia University and occupies a newly created position at the university, Columbia Artist. This is Fresh Air.